in association with Newsarama, and for the benefit of Mr. Kite, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, I bring you more of my coverage of the FX International Convention from Orlando that happened last month. A great time was had by all, and partly because of these people you'll be hearing today on Word Balloon. Olivier Coipel will be talking about Thor, House of M, and some possible future plans with Marvel. Matt Kent, who does wonderful work for Top Shelf on books like Super Spy and Pistol Whip. We'll be talking about some new projects for Matt coming up. Tony Bedard discusses Rebels for DC Comics. Chuck Dixon will be talking about his work on G.I. Joe for IDW and his Bongo Comics work for The Simpsons. Steve Rude, lots of new Nexus product along the way. And Arthur Soydum, who will be talking about work coming up from Radical Publishing and Heavy Metal. Now, in the weeks and months ahead, a lot of these interviews will also be popping up as videos, but wanted to give you the information while it's still hot off the presses. So without further ado, my FXCon coverage right here on Word Balloon.
John Suntress here at the FX International Convention in Orlando, and it's been a great weekend so far. One of the great Marvel success stories lately has been the revamp of Thor. J. Michael Straczynski doing the writing, and the man right here, Olivier Coipel, doing the art and doing a wonderful job. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, too.
I have to ask, how much of the new look of Thor was what Joe gave you in the script and how much of your own vision?
All right. Joe, at the very beginning, before getting the script, he asked me to do some redesigns of Thor and different characters and Asgard, stuff like that. And he said, okay, can you get inspired by Lord of the Ring, the movie, stuff like that? So I started from that, and then I did my own stuff. I went back to read Jack Kirby stuff, because I wanted to go back to the basics, because I think for me it was going, Thor has evolved differently with a bear and everything, so I wanted to go back to the basics, you know, so a shorter cloak, cape, and shorter hair, stuff like that, the most simple thing, you know, but at the same time redesigning it. So at the beginning I looked at the Lord of the Ring, and I bought a lot of books about Vikings, stuff like that, and I mixed it up with different stuff that I saw on TV. Like I saw a shirt from a soccer team.
Okay.
And it has this design like this on the side. So I got inspired by that, so I mixed it up, everything.
Oh, that's really cool. What about the armor, the chainmail armor that he has and everything? Is that, because it's interesting, you'd think a god wouldn't need that much protection.
Yeah.
I like the look, but I was just interested in the choice of giving him more armor as opposed to what we've seen before.
Yeah, because I wanted him to have a warrior look, you know,
okay.
To get, even if he's a god, I wanted him to be protected. Less, I mean, the first design that I did was totally different from the Marvel 4 that we know.
Absolutely.
So it was totally like Viking design oriented, stuff like that, but totally different. So Marvel asked me, okay, but we need to recognize that it's the Thor from Marvel, you know? So I went in between, but I kept the chainmail because I thought it was cool to draw. And because at the beginning, the chainmail was on his body and his arm were bare. Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
And then I mixed it up because I wanted to keep the chainmails, so I put it on his arms and his legs.
That's cool. Well, and one design that has taken a drastic difference is, of course, Loki. And that's really been fun to see because it is at the same time seductive, which is what it's supposed to be, a little creepy because we know it's really Loki. And tell me about the dynamics of that.
I tell you frankly, the very first design that I did on Loki, I didn't do any sketches before because I was in a rush to finish issue four or five, I can't remember when he appears. So I did the design straight on the page. But so I did. Yeah, I didn't have time, so I was just I did quickly, and then little by little, you know, after the following issues, I noticed that I didn't like that much the design because the faces was too generic, like she was just a beautiful lady. That's
yes.
It. So one day I came up, I saw on TV, I saw Marilyn Manson, and I thought, okay, because he has this double, you know,
sure.
Bisexual, you know, you don't know if he's a guy or a woman. So I was, that's the thing I should play with, you know. So I removed the eyebrow, even the face, I made the face a bit longer.
Yes.
And that's how I played. So it came up, you know, issues after issues, I started to found the right face for that. And I thought it was more interesting than making her just beautiful, you know.
Well, I know issue 600 came out, and that you've now wrapped up with Thor. Are you just covers now for Thor? Or?
No, not different. Not even for these different covers for different books. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, before Thor, people knew you from your miniseries with Brian Bendis, House of M.
Yeah.
And Thor was kind of an event on its own, or became an event because of the quality of the story. House of M was supposed to be an event from the start. As an artist, is it tougher to... Do you feel more pressure or any concern, more concern, because this isn't like House of M was the summer event for the company, as opposed to just, you know, a regular monthly?
No, I think it was just... The difference was the time that I started to do House of M. House of M was my first main big stories, you know, in the Marvel Universe. So I got pressure for that. And because there are so many characters, I had pressure. Because even Marvel communicate with me saying that this is the big summer event, stuff like that. So I had pressure doing that. But Thor was different because I was more used to that. And because Thor was one of the characters that I really wanted to work on, I had less pressure, I guess, somehow. I think now I start to get used to that kind of pressure, I guess.
Okay.
Like every artist, you know, at the beginning, the first time, you're like, oh, how am I going to handle that? Am I going to be able to do it? And then after a while, you get used to that, I guess. Just quiet down and do your stuff. I mean, that's what I know how to do, you know, so...
How is it different working with the two different writers, Joe Straczynski and Brian Bendis?
Okay, yeah, there's a big difference, yeah. I mean, because Bendis talks a lot, so you can... Yeah, but even you can... But it's fun because he's so enthusiastic. So it's easy to talk to him, and even if you write an email, he's going to answer for you. But JMS is more like a quiet guy, you know, you just receive the script.
Okay.
And no news, nothing.
No?
No, not at all. Not at all.
No feedback at all?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, good news, the fans all love. I think, you know, and as evidenced by the line of fans that have come here today and the people we're seeing.
And you know what? At the end, it's the same job, because even if they don't communicate the same, I have the script and I do what I want to do with the script, you know. So at the end, what's coming on the page is the same. I mean, it's the same way of working.
It was fun to discover. I didn't realize it at the time that before your Marvel work at DC, you had done so much Legion of Superhero work, and with Abnett and Lanning on their regular The Legion series, and Legion Lost as well, which is a wonderful series. So I really enjoyed your work back then, and it's fun to see your DC work. And I know obviously that was earlier on,
and
you've grown as an artist since. But it's fun to look back at that stuff as well for me as a reader.
Even for me, because at the beginning it was hard. Yeah. I tell you to look at the drawings, like, oh, how did I do that? How come I did something like that, you know? But today, I have Legion was my very first work, and I stayed so long on the book that I'm really attached to this book emotionally, you know?
Okay.
So I hope one day, my mind is always like, one day I'm going to come back to draw some Legion story, because this is my first job, you know, my first work.
Excellent. I know Marvel's not done with you, and we haven't heard yet, but I would be watching in the future because they're... Not at all? Not at all? Oh. McCann is telling us. Jim McCann is off camera right now telling us he's done. That's it. It's over. I know there's big announcements coming later in the summer for Olivier, and we can't talk about it now, but we'll all just kind of scratch our heads and wonder what's coming up. But we're all very excited about it. Beautiful work, man. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Continued success, and we really look forward to the new announcements and the new projects. So nice going.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. John Sutris back here at the FX convention in Orlando, Florida. Very happy to finally have a moment on video to speak with one of my favorite guys from Top Shelf. Super Spy, Pop Gun, really cool stuff, a very unique style. It's Matt Kent. It's a pleasure to talk to you, man.
How's it going?
Doing good. And as always, man, Super Spy, I think, is one of the best books out there that is an incredible value. It's going to sound like a commercial, but it's true. This amazing value where you've got tons of little interconnected stories. It's one of my favorite genres, the Cold War, or really World War II espionage.
Yeah.
And also just your very unique painting style. I just think it's just beautiful, man.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Why did you choose the era of the 30s and 40s to put your stories in?
You know, I've always been attracted to that era for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is just superficial, the way stuff looks, the way people dress, the cars, all that. World War II, it's hard not to get a good story out of that. I mean, there's so much that happened during that time that I'm really attracted to that. And then personally, like, I had a grandfather who died in World War II, so I've always had some sort of connection to that that era.
Well, and also, how quickly does it take you to a page? Because your style is deceptively simple. I mean, you're a really good storyteller, and what you're, you know, it's kind of in a different way, like Art Balthazar, where it looks like your style, like somebody would go, well, I could do that, and it's like, I don't think so. And a lot of it might be just the way you lay out a story, but you tell me, how long does it take you to, like, do a page?
Yeah, boy, I don't know. It takes me probably an hour, two, like a, I don't know. I can do 24 pages of pencils in a week.
Wow.
And then it takes me an hour to ink a page. Because I just started timing myself this last week to see when I was going to get my next book done. And, but to me, the art isn't about pouring a ton of detail into it. It's storytelling. So,
sure.
To me, I feel like I'm more of a cartoonist and not an illustrator. I think there's a big difference between those two.
How organically do these books grow in terms of, like, did you know Super Spy was going to be a certain length? Or did you realize after a while, oh, you know, this is going to be bigger than I thought?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't sure how long it was going to be. I knew what characters I had, and I knew where those characters were going to start and where they were going to end, who's going to die, and then everything in between sort of, you know, it kind of writes itself a little bit. The characters are going to do what they're going to do, and then I just sort of follow them, and then it ends up being what it is.
I also like the kind of mixed media that you put in the books as well, where we've got little telegram notes and you know, newspaper headlines and things like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of a pack rat, and I love going to estate sales, so I'm always collecting, like, little cards and postcards and like, old letters and all that stuff, so I love the way that stuff looks. And I wanted to do a book where you open it up, and it's like you find this box of secret stuff, and then you kind of have to sort through it and figure it out.
Yeah, they do kind of represent clues in the stories, and it does kind of have a more tactile feel than just reading a story. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, and I feel like I really wanted to make this book look like it was old. Like, you just picked it up, and it had been around for 60 years, you know? And then I got a chance to do that, and with Top Shelf, they kind of let me run wild with the design and do whatever I wanted to do, so I just made it look old and beat up, and I thought, it looks good, and then it kind of goes with the characters, too. So these characters are going through a lot, and they're kind of roughed up and just fit the feel of the stories.
What's coming up for you in the future?
I have a book from Dark Horse coming out in September called Three Story, The Secret History of the Giant Man. And it's about a guy who grows three stories tall. And but it's kind of a weird story, and it takes place over the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And it's from the point of view of his mother, and then his wife, and then his daughter.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But, yeah, it's 200 pages, full color, and kind of like the same size as Super Spies.
Will it come out as an OGN, or will it come out as issues?
Yeah, it's definitely an OGN. It's hardcover. It's got a fancy die cut and everything.
Wow.
And but yeah, it's done. It's just I have to fix a few typos before it goes to press. But.
Excellent. So later this year?
Yep, September. So it'll be out for SPX.
Excellent, man. I know you're an old radio fan as well as I am, and we always end up talking about that in cons. And that's what I really like. I think these are interesting period pieces. They've got a modern independent spin on them, and it ends up being a very unique package provided by Matt Kent, who does a great job. Look for his stuff. Look for Super Spy. And it is Pop Gun, am I right?
Super Spy and
what am I thinking of? What's the 30s radio one?
Pistol Whip.
Sorry. See, I was calling it Pop Gun. It's Pistol Whip. No. But I have them both, and I really enjoy them from Top Shelf. And looking forward now to the three-story giant, man.
Yep.
Awesome, man. Matt Kent, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, dude.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
John Sutcher's back here at the FX International Show, and very happy to spend a moment with a Floridian and a fine man that I've enjoyed his work going back to the CrossGen years, writer Tony Bedard. It's good to see you, Tony.
Well, thanks for having me.
And really glad that I know you've come on a few books and done a few books here and there. You closed out the story in Birds of Prey, but Rebels seems to be an attempt on DC's part to really kind of give you, from the ground up, a book and say, here, Tony, run. And you're running well. I think the pace has been great, and I think the stories have been very cool.
Yeah, it's been a mutual attempt, because this was something I've been trying to get going with DC since I started over there. Sometimes you inherit a book, and it comes with all these preconceptions of who the characters are. And also something like Birds of Prey, where you have Chuck Dixon and Gail Simone, you know, those are big shoes to fill. So I get to start from the ground up on this one, and it's been a lot of fun. It's working out probably the best of anything I've done at DC so far.
I've been a big fan of these characters as well, going back to the mid-'80s when I think Vreel Docs, one of the Brainiac family. We're getting inside baseball now, kids, but I know you're up to snuff on all this stuff. That was really a fun series of the 80s and early 90s. And it's one, though, that kind of was in its own world. And it seems like in this incarnation with Rebels, both feet, even though we're out in outer space, it's definitely in the DC universe. And we're seeing a lot more of the mainstream side of the DC universe in this science fiction motif.
Well, to begin with, we do, because I wanted to root it with something that people already care about. So we start on Earth and we see Supergirl, but then it takes off and does its own thing. Because I think we've had enough of stories that are so intertwined with everything else that they don't really develop their own personality. And we're trying to give this enough time where you get to know these characters on their own terms and also give them their own corner of the universe to play in. They're in an area of the Vegas sector that's really the most lawless corner of the DC universe. And whereas a cosmic book like Green Lantern deals with heroics and you know, good and evil in more classical terms, this is a lot more gray area in this book and a lot more anti-heroic.
So we're seeing kind of the interplanetary politics and stuff.
Yeah, and we didn't want to hit the same note as some of the other cosmic stuff. This is more down and dirty and more unpredictable. It's one of those books where you really don't know who's going to survive in a given issue. And with a hero like Vreel Docs, who will do anything to get his way, although, thank goodness, what he wants to do is generally good, but he doesn't mind if you die for him to get it done.
Excellent. Tell me about your artist on the series.
Oh, Andy Clark is the best thing about this book, and I am so lucky to have him. He's a guy that has been on contract at DC for a few years, but never really found his big break. And so I managed to snap him up, and he is doing the best work. I can't say enough good stuff. It's like a... There's like 10 different great, great artists that I see in his work. And it's not that he's copying anybody, but... Kevin McGuire, I think you can see in there, and Barry Kitson, you can see some. I'm drawing a blank here. The guy who used to do Wildcats, Travis Charest.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's highly detailed stuff. Really nice.
Excellent. You know, before we started rolling tape, we were talking, and you were saying, unfortunately, being here in Florida, you're kind of outside the New York, D.C. loop, and it's kind of tougher to, you know, be able to bounce ideas and everything and kind of, you know, other than really talking to yourself. But I understand your son has been a wealth of inspiration.
Yeah, he's 10 years old, and maybe he's just absorbed enough hanging around me that he's going to be hopelessly weird when he grows up. But right now, we walk to school, and I'll just, you know, I'll throw different characters at him. You know, what do you think of this guy? And he actually comes up with really good stuff, so... You know, either that or my book's going to read like it was written by a 10-year-old. I can't tell anymore.
Man, and I know we're in Florida, and that's cross-gen country, and just a couple tables away, I saw Mike Perkins, and I was thinking I knew I was going to run into Tony. My thoughts went back to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. That brief couple issues, I got to tell you, you guys knocked me out with that series.
Yeah, we got 5 issues out on that book. It was so much fun. It was really Mike's original idea that we built up together. The 6th issue, the last issue, is all drawn and lettered. It's sitting somewhere. It never saw the light of day. So somebody's going to get the bright idea to collect this and finally tell the whole story. It's out there, you know.
It would be nice. I know Checker was doing a lot of reprint stuff of CrossGen. It's been nice to see the Negation stuff come back out from you guys. Because, again, and that's why I think Rebels is a nice shot in the arm for DC, because I think you've already kind of shown your interplanetary chops with Negation. And I see some kindred stories between the two and themes. So I think that's got to be fun to kind of come back to.
Oh, I've been trying to recapture that Negation experience ever since CrossGen went under. It was probably the best, most complete creative experience in my career. And this is getting into that area once again, Rebels is. It feels a lot like Negation used to. And the one thing I wish that I could do is sit under the same roof with Andy Clark and really just talk through these things. We've had some good back and forth over the internet, and his designs are amazing. But there's nothing like being right there with somebody and, you know, having a beer or having lunch and just hashing out all the stuff.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully you guys will get more chances to do that as the series goes on. We're only on 3 issues. The 3rd issue just came out this week. Have you gotten a decent response from the fans on this one?
It's been really positive, and it's also been gratifying that it's been very positive in the DC offices. The Brian Cunningham, who's the editor on the book, tells me about how people stop him in the hall all the time, other people on the DC staff, and tell him how much they're enjoying the book. And it's come as a big surprise to him, because everybody gets very fixated on whatever the big event is, you know, or the thing that's getting the most marketing push. And a book like this can be a real surprise. So what we've hoped for all along is that we'd be a bit of a sleeper, get some buzz, and slowly build an audience. You know, ideally, that's how you do it.
Sure, and that's been the good news. I said this before at one of my other interviews. You know, C-level characters that you kind of take for granted, but in the right hands, the characters elevate, and suddenly you've got a compelling story, and that's what you're getting with Rebels and Tony Bedard. So nice going, Tony. Keep it up, and we'll be watching.
All right. Thanks, John.
John Suntress from WordBalloon.com back here at the FX International Show in Orlando. And when I come to Florida, I'm always happy to see this guy. One of my favorite writers for years. He's any genre, put it in his hands, you're going to get a dynamite story. It's Chuck Dixon, who actually does have a dynamite project apparently in the works. And that wasn't meant to be a play on words, but that's an opportunity to lead to Man With No Name, which is coming up, I guess, for you.
That's the kind of clever guy you are, John. You just picked right up on that. It's I'm doing Man With No Name. We're retitling it, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, starting the series over with number one.
Okay.
And it's for Dynamite. And it's myself on scripts and a new, new to the United States artist, Estev Burrell.
Okay.
So, and he's doing some amazingly detailed work. It's I've always wanted to do a spaghetti western, and this one's coming out pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. Well, I know you've done other westerns before, so tell me, like, what is the difference in doing The Man With No Name?
Well, he's like the original anti-hero, where it's just about, you know, the whole world's about him. And it is about, it's all about money and profit and how things are going to work out best for him. He's utterly amoral. The only thing that makes him sympathetic is that the people he's up against are so incredibly vile. So, and it's a test to see, you know, it's always a test of endurance and speed and everything with this guy.
How hard are you able to go from a rating standpoint with this story? I mean, is this going to be an R? Or, I mean, like, you know, you sometimes with Dynamite, you've got, like, The Boys, which is incredibly hardcore, and then you've got, you know, other books that are kind of all-ages books. But where would you put this series with Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
I'd say it's a solid PG-13. I mean, the original Man With No Name trilogy, it's not very graphic violence-wise, and there's never any language. You know, and there's never any sex. I mean, spaghetti westerns are remarkably sexless. So, you know, as far as language, you know, period language and stuff, I'd say a PG-13. And it's violent, but it's not gory.
All right. Are you coming back to any villains or anything that we've seen in any of the past films? Or
now this one pretty much is like right after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We can assume he spent all that money or lost it somehow. And he's now... he's pursuing a train robber wanted by the railroads, $5,000 bounty, and the train robber joins a group of ex-Confederate soldiers going to Mexico to fight for Maximilian, the emperor of Mexico, against the Juaristas. And so we end up deep in Mexico with bandits, French Foreign Legionnaires, a gold train, and all kinds of crazy action.
And then switching from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly to G.I. Joe, working for IDW. Did you ever write G.I. Joe before in its past incarnations?
Well, when I first started working at Marvel, Larry was writing G.I. Joe, and he was my main editor. So I was kind of like there at the birth. And then a number of years later, I wrote four issues for Devil's Due with Beachhead. And that's it. So,
well, and tell us about this current series you got going on for G.I. Joe.
Well, we're sort of the main catch-all reader-friendly book. We're the monthly ongoing that will tell the main story, and then the other books tell ancillary stuff or spotlight certain characters. But we've got them all. We've got all 200, however many Joes. And the big story for us is that we're at the point where the Joes do not know about Cobra. So they are learning about Cobra over the course of our book month to month, which makes it the perfect jump on point for new readers. And hopefully a lot of, like, goosebump moments for older readers, you know, and longtime fans.
You and Butch Geiser are wrapping up that Wildstorm alternate World War II book. And I'm sorry, Chuck, I'm blanking right
Storming
now.
Paradise.
Storming Paradise. Thank you very much. A what-if story that basically postulates, what if the bomb didn't work and we had to go through with the land invasion of Japan and events sue from, you know, stemming from that? That's, you know, interesting contrast to go from, you know, real hard World War II stuff to the world of G.I. Joe, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Joe is more of like a military fantasy, but, you know, Joe is great because there's so many science fiction elements and things like that that you it's all crazy stuff that you have to make believable and make work. But, you know, Larry laid it all down. I mean, I'd have to work really hard to screw it up. But instead, I'm working hard to make it really good. But I just read his first Origins issue, and boy, I got to up my game because it's astounding.
Excellent. One of my favorite books last year was the Simpsons book that Chuck wrote. It was, again, a World War II motif. It was Abe Simpson and the Fighting Hellfish, and a great story, and an untold tale of Grandpa Simpson. And I thought that was really cool. What do you got coming up for Bago?
I got a story where Monty Burns decides that after he dies, he wants his work to continue, but not as a foundation or a philanthropic effort, but instead they build a computer called Big Monty, which will basically continue everything that Montgomery Burns would have done in life. And it manages to go online and begins email relationship with Lisa Simpson. And things get really nuts from there. So, but that was a lot of fun to write. But and then a number of others. The Free Comic Book Day this year has one of my stories.
Very cool.
Aptly entitled, There's No Such Thing as a Free Comic. And, I got quite a few things coming out from them. But that World War II thing was cool. And
that was great,
that's one I didn't pitch. They just said, Dan Spiegel wants to do The Simpsons.
I was going to say, there was Dan Spiegel doing the art, too. That's awesome.
They
man.
Said, Dan Spiegel wants to do The Simpsons. What do you want to do for him? And I was like, there's only one thing I want to do for him. I want to do an old DC war comic with Abe Simpson as Sergeant Rock. So that's where we went.
Turned out great, too, man. Again, that's what I like about Chuck. Chuck, you know, he knows the genres. He knows how to put his own spin on things. And I honestly almost wonder, I mean, and I don't want you to give away any house secrets or anything. You've got a writer's panel, I know, coming up this weekend. But, when you write stories, is it like how much of it is the craft of how you've, you know, learned to write comics, the balance between that and the original ideas you come up with?
Well, I mean, craft is how you bring it to the reader. You know, anybody can come up with a nutty idea. You've got to learn how to dramatize it and present it. And clarity is so important in comics. You've got to keep it clear. Because if you lose the reader for one panel, you've lost them and you're not going to get them back. So it's the five C's of cinematography for storytelling. You know, figure out what to do there. And then, I just learned by reading a whole lot of comics. So it's almost like a second language to me. And it's just a matter of keeping it clear for the reader.
Well, I think through the years we've seen it, whether it's been 8-page stories or 6-issue arcs, ongoing series and stuff, Chuck always has an answer. And, his years were in the Bat universe as well, Birds of Prey, creating Birds of Prey, and the stuff he did with Nightwing. I haven't had a chance to ask you what you thought of The Dark Knight. How'd they do with the movie?
I haven't seen it.
Really?
No, I haven't seen it.
Wow.
It's hard. It's like, for years I didn't want to write any Star Wars comics because once you write it, it's ruined for you. Because then you're not watching it, enjoying it. You're watching it thinking, now what would I do? And Batman, it's really hard to watch anything Batman. Because it's like, well, what would I have done? Or the worst one, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, I understand.
So, but I will have to see it. You know, I hear, well, obviously, great.
I
hear good things. It might make it. You know, it's got legs, I hear. So I'm eventually going to have to see it. But
excellent. That's all right.
Well, we'll enjoy your work still on G.I. Joe. Coming up, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as well, and more Simpsons comics. It's Chuck Dixon. It's good to see you, man.
Okay, thank you, John.
John Suntress back here at the FX Con in Orlando, Florida. So happy to run into a guy that I've had the pleasure to speaking to on the phone, who was one of the original voices coming from the direct market boom of the 80s and really made a big splash with Nexus, continued to do beautiful work for Marvel and DC, and is back doing his wonderful characters like Nexus and the Moth. It's the dude, folks. It's Steve Root. It's a pleasure to see you, Steve.
Well, thanks, John. It's good. It's good to be talking with you again by way of mic and camera.
Yes, and we get to go face to face. I know that the current arc, Space Opera, for Nexus fell a little bit off on schedule, but it's back on schedule now, and you've got a lot of products coming up in the next few months. One thing I know about, which is Nexus the Origin in a prestige format, is already available in the previews. What can you tell the people about that?
The Origin came about because people said, well, it's out of print. Let's put it back into print. So we put it back in print. New cover, some good stuff in the back, all that kind of stuff that makes the book even later than it normally is.
What I respect about another book that you've got coming out, too, is you're putting out a black and white version of, and it's called Nexus As It Happened. And that's kind of cool. And it's nice that you're offering these products at different price points and stuff, so people who haven't had an opportunity to be exposed to Nexus are able to come in, and if they want all the bells and whistles, they can go high-end, but also in the case of the black and white, get the story, get the basic art and everything, and get it at a maybe a smaller price.
Yeah, you know, Janelle, my wife, had an idea that it might be kind of cool to put out an essentials type of a deal, since they seem to be what everyone is doing nowadays, and I thought it was a good idea. You know, I would never okay something that I didn't think it was a good idea, and we just decided to put it out in the same format that that Dark Horse was putting out the expensive ones, but just not make them expensive.
That's cool. One, I love the full color Nexus, but your stuff is so vivid that really I think the story does pop in black and white in a very cool and pulpy sort of way, which fits the idea behind Nexus, I guess.
Well, the guys that I artistically was influenced heavily by were artists that basically worked in a black and white sort of manner. Cast shadows, you know, a lot of black spotting, things like that. That's what we all grew up on, the Alex Toth kind of stuff, and, you know, Kirby, what he did. So that's probably part of the look that you're talking about and why it happened.
Well, and what I like, too, is when you do get the occasional mainstream work for DC or Marvel, it always seems you go back to the basics on a lot of these characters. I think of personal favorite of mine, of course, was when Superman fought the Hulk. It really felt like it was the 1962 Hulk meeting the 1938 Superman.
Yeah, basically, I'm just glad they let me get away with it, because I know they could come down on me in ways so unsightly that we would all end up in jail, and tell me I couldn't do things like bring back the original Superman and the original Hulk, things like that. You know, those were the versions I grew up on. The really characters really don't have any resonance for me unless they look like that. So it was important to do it like that, too.
Yeah, you know, another one that I love, too, was Captain America, What Price Glory. It really felt like that late 60s kind of Cap, Shield, Steranko, and even Kirby, I know, came back and did a little bit in the middle of the Steranko run. But it seemed like, do you see that in characters? You kind of have a specific kind of era and say, that's Superman, that's Batman, that's Spider-Man, that's Cap?
Yes. In fact, it's real easy just to look down the line of the books that I drew for DC and Marvel, and you'll see, you know, World's Finest was the original Superman. I was paying homage in my belief in the fact that he was the best of all Supermen. When I worked at Marvel, it was the Kirby Hulk and the original Superman again, because I believe so much in the look of those particular versions. Spider-Man was Romita, because I grew up with Romita. Cap was Kirby, of course. And Thor was Kirby.
Yes. That's great, man. Well, and, you know, now you've got your new character, the Moth. I know you'll be getting back to them to him after finishing the space opera story. And from what I understand, too, Nexus, what would have been Nexus 101 and 102, you're putting together and making a 48-page double-sized book.
Yeah, it was a decision made just out of practicality. And that I took so long to put these books together, and I was kind of basically ashamed about it. And I'm still trying to figure out why this happened like that. But at least I know the books would always be good. But it was just way, way overdue for turning the book out to the public. It's finally done. It's colored. It's ready to go. I just got to finish my cover. But the decision about, you know, doubling them up was made because, as an independent publisher, when you see the bill come back for an individual comic, it's pretty incredible. So you start to think about, well, if we just double these issues up, and it makes sense, you know, let's give people more bang for their bucks anyway. So it was a decision made out of practicality and just you know, why not? It makes more sense than losing money or not putting them together as a single issue.
Reviving characters seems to be in the current zeitgeist. I know some publishers are bringing back not only Buck Rogers, but even England's Dan Dare. And it seems like it's a good time again for sci-fi comics. And I'm glad to see Nexus is back. And, you know, I mean, it's been fun to see the new spins that some of these new creators are putting on these classic characters. But in the case of Nexus, well, I think you were ahead of your time, and also an homage to the pulp era back then, and I think Nexus continues to be that kind of book.
Yes, and you'll notice that when we picked up with the book last year, there was really no any sense of change that took place, because there was no change that was needed in the book. We just kind of picked up where we left off, and just, you know, did the book the best that we knew how.
You had an amazing original run on Nexus, and to come back now, I mean, are there infinite stories to come? I mean, how far do you and Mike have the Nexus adventures mapped out?
Well, it's true. There are actually infinite stories to come. You know, if you're not limited by your sense of, you know, what you dream up in your imagination, then there's really no end in sight to the thing. We ultimately, I think, the book would probably go until we retire. You know, 15 years from now, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, do you really see a 15-year kind of stop poster? I mean, hell, look at Kubert and some of the guys, John Severin, Joe Kubert and stuff. They're still going, and they seem to be, you know, inspired to continue and stuff.
Well, I know that the Moth is certainly got, you know, a no sight and end kind of a prospect. Nexus is hard to say.
Okay.
So we'll just have to see and
well,
wait.
You've written a lot of stories with the character. That's why I was wondering. But, you know, that's cool. I know you've had some other concepts that I've seen on your website as well. And we should mention your website. It is steverud.com?
It's steve@steverud.com.
Okay.
Last time I checked.
and I mean, in our audio conversation, you mentioned that Amazing Dude Tales will be coming up, and it sounds like you'll be having fun with some other genres when you get to that.
That's going to be exciting because, you know, just from a position of, you know, how to be smart and how not to be dumb, you're going to naturally include the main characters in that Amazing Dude Tales anthology book. And then you're going to go into other characters that we created, which we haven't explored yet, but should be a lot of fun to do. That's part of the fun of the whole Rude Dude experience, is to, oh, well, I've always wanted to do that. Let's, you know, we got the Silencer, we got, you know, Origami, we got this character and that character. And they've all got lives that haven't been told, explored yet. So that's really exciting. And then we got this other thing where I'm going to revive romance stories. And, yeah, people think, if people have any sense of that being kind of a joke, it's not. These stories, I mean, when you think about it, every story ever told has got some romantic aspect in the story. So, you know, you take stories out of today's headlines, just like they did back in the 50s, taking them out of the 1950s headlines. And the final thing we have is a horror genre kind of a thing. Nothing gross, in keeping with my sensibility of what I will allow and what I won't allow, but simply to scare your pants off just by the sheer horror of it all. And we've got something that's in the first issue of Amazing Dude Tales that is actually a true story that happened at a prison, a local prison in Arizona, told to me by a guard who was hanging out at one of the Phoenix conventions one time, and he started to tell me the story. It became so unbearably freaky to me, scared me out of my mind, kind of a deal, where I made him stop telling me the story and said, look, why don't we just wait until until I have to read the story before, or when I actually have to do the story before I have to, you know, read this, hear about this. This insane story. It's just nuts. It's just scariest thing I've ever heard, I think.
Who are your horror influences? Because I know how much you highly regard Jack Kirby. But from a horror standpoint, who are some of your guys?
Well, I guess I would go right to, you know, thinking of film, John, I would probably just go right to The Haunting of Hill House, the Robert Wise movie.
Absolutely.
And what's the other one that scared me so bad? Maybe Psycho?
Oh, great.
Psycho got a little crazy, but, you know, it was within the borders of sanity, so I could sleep at night. There was another one that I'm trying to think, but yeah, it's mostly just the haunting, you know, the breathing walls and stuff and all the, you know, in-your-head kind of stuff without doing the things that almost every director felt like they had to resort to for the last 20 years, which is gore and things like that, gore and shock. It's just not my thing.
You know, you strike me as someone that would be kind of a Warren fan as well. And I wonder if any of that stuff ever influenced you, because they kind of had that, a lot of those guys, Gene Colan and, you know, certainly Frazetta and some of these other guys had really clean lines just like your stuff. And I wonder if that stuff ever, you know, influenced you, or you were a fan of it as a reader? Or?
No, I really wasn't, John. I was mostly just reading my Romita and my Kirby and sticking to that.
Because, you know, these black and white collections that Dark Horse has put out, and, you know, sounded kind of like it was the vibe that you were trying to come up with from a horror standpoint with your Root Dude tales. So, but I'm glad to hear that it is kind of more cinematic as opposed to some of these other comic influences.
No, I'm sure that if I read the creepy and eerie stuff, I'm sure I'd find similarities.
You almost want to stay away from other creators and kind of keep your inspirations pure from a cartooning standpoint?
Well, that's an interesting question. Stay away from other creators, you mean?
Yeah. You know, other than the ones that you've already been exposed to that did influence your style, as far, you know, like, and I understand your feelings about some of the current books and the directions that they go in, but like we said, like, you didn't read the Warren stuff. Would you stay away from that then while you're kind of creating? And also, these horror stories, as you say, are based more on today's headlines as opposed to those were kind of evoking, you know, some of the 40s and 50s horror films and things. I don't know.
No, what I actually want to stay away from most is today's comic books. I don't like the way they're done. I don't like the way they read. I don't like the way they're drawn. I think they're obviously done by a generation of people so far removed from my standards of practice, so to speak, they're not enjoyable for me. And I would only read them because they're enjoyable. So if I want to read a comic book, I have to go to the past.
I understand. Well, the beautiful thing is you take those past influences and create fresh material in The Moth, in Nexus, and a lot of Nexus product out available now and coming in the months ahead. They're already in the current previews, and keep checking previews every month, because you'll see the Nexus Black and White stuff coming up, also the conclusion of Space Opera, and the Prestige Nexus Origin. So it's a pleasure to talk to the dude in person as opposed to the phone, but we will speak again on the phone, and it's good seeing you.
Oh, thank you very much. You're a great guy in your profession.
I appreciate that. Thank you. John Sutter's back here at the FX Con in Orlando, and very happy to have a moment to speak with Arthur Soydum, because likewise, man, because I've been a fan for years, and on the one hand, I'm thrilled that everyone is so excited to see your zombified stuff. But, hell, man, I go back, you know, and was reading all the covers of all the fine black and white stuff that you did for years and heavy metal. But I'm, again, happy that this new interest and excitement has come for these zombified recreations that you've been doing.
Thanks. I think, you know, what it is it's kind of, if you work for one of the big two, for one of the mainstream companies, then you get noticed. It doesn't matter what kind of work you do. If you're not working for one of the two mainstreams, the work pretty much gets overlooked in comics. So the Marvel Zombies was really the first mainstream series that I've ever done for a mainstream company. So and since then, I've been working on some of the other mainstream characters, Wolverine and some of the other ones, and Fantastic Four, and they're being fairly well received. So it's a good thing. It's something I should have did a long time ago.
It's nice, though, too, that based on the success of the zombie stuff, and I know it wasn't just for Marvel and DC. I know Ben Edlund, for his 10th anniversary for The Tick, you did that zombified Tick.
Right.
And some of the, you know, and you've reached out to these other companies as well with zombified things. So have they come to you and asked, or have you just kind of?
Yeah, no, they come to me. Yeah, they come to me, and it's all good fun. It's all good fun and great practice.
By the same token, I was happy to see some recent Red Sonja covers that you did, and back to the classic fantasy stuff. So that's kind of cool.
Those are some of my favorite covers to paint, because in mainstream comics, there's not a lot of opportunities to do characters that are not superheroes. So when you come across some and an opportunity to do classical genre like what Red Sonja is, for an illustrator like myself, those are opportunities that are far and few in between, and so I like to take those when I can get them. So
I know there's a kind of revival for, outside of fantasy, some pulp heroes and stuff. Would we seeing any painted pulp stuff from you, possibly?
Well, I've been doing a lot of film noir pulp stuff for Hard Case Crime, basically.
You know, excellent. You know, I think I saw one of Max Collins' books come back, and didn't you do the cover for that?
No, I've done the Woolrich book. I did Mickey Spillane's last book, as a matter of fact.
Great.
Right before he passed away, so I got to do the cover for that. The other one escapes me. The third one escapes me. But I've done three of them so far.
Who of those classic pulp and paperback cover artists were influences of yours,
if any?
I like them all.
Okay.
I like them all. Yeah, I like all those guys. I'm less familiar with their names because they're before my time.
I hear.
While I know most artists by their work.
I see.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It all looks good to me.
Me too, man. And. You know, you were talking before we started rolling that you're going to be doing a lot of work for Radical Publishing.
Yes, yes.
And have already begun and will continue to do so.
Yes, 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 yes. So I'm working on Hercules for Radical, working on a book called Shrapnel, which is sexy science fiction. They do a lot of the classics, so they fall into the category of what I was just mentioning, that I like to work on classical work. It gives me a chance to compete with the great illustrators of bygone eras, which is fun for me. That's half the fun of it. So working on Aladdin for them, and they're also putting out a couple graphic novels of mine. The series is called Charlie and Flytrap, Center City, and that's one that I actually wrote the entire story and did all the interior illustration as well.
Wow. Oh, that'll be fun to see some interior stuff for me.
That's coming out shortly. That's coming out in June.
Oh, that's great. You know, and that is, I think one of the wonderful things is cover artists as yourself are the initial draw to a book once people see that. And sometimes when they see a different style inside, it's like, oh, that's too bad. And a good friend, Dan Brereton, I was saying how much that's why I loved Thrill Killer and his Nocturnal stuff. So this will be great to see what you bring to a cover and see it internally. That's great.
One would hope.
Was it? I mean, that's got to be time-consuming to be able to do interiors like that.
Oh, yeah, that's the main thing that keeps me away from it is that it is so time-consuming because coming to it as an illustrator, you have to put all this work into it for me, and you won't be happy with the work unless you put all the work into it. So that's one of the things that keeps me away from it. So I have to really pick and choose my spots where I'm going to do interior illustration. But I also have another graphic novel that's coming out through Heavy Metal. That's a 100-page graphic novel. It's all painted interiors that I did the writing on as well. And I have a couple treatments from Marvel for an Avengers series right now.
Cool.
So shopping them to Marvel, and we'll see how that goes.
That's excellent, man. You know, a lot of times in the mainstream, they lean on the realistic styles of Alex Ross and guys like that. It's nice to see that your style is going to be brought into possibly an Avengers.
The same. I mean, Alex, I think we're the two guys who really, the two illustrators in the business who really paint. We come to the industry as painters, and so I kind of look at it as being in the same field. It's like we do the same type of work, basically.
Well, and there's room for more, and I'm glad. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I see the style difference, and nothing against Alex. I love Alex's stuff as well.
Beautiful. Alex is beautiful.
But and you two provide iconic images in a very different style. It's beautiful, you know. I'm a big fan of the Frazetta stuff, and you know,
painted work versus the line work. Those are the two differences, right? Right. Yeah.
Well, continued success, man. Beautiful stuff, and looking forward to the stuff from Radical and Heavy Metal, and from Marvel as well. It's Arthur Soydum and A Baby's Crime because they're that excited about it.
Zombies make them cry. What can I say?
That's it. We got a couple more floor interviews coming from the FX Con and a couple panels that I did as well because, really, there were some very cool people at the FX Con that you haven't heard from yet. But we do have tape from Dave Johnson and Sean Galloway in the world of animation, Phil Noto and Ruben Procopio, Billy Tucci, Dan Brereton and Joe Michael Linzer, Michael Golden, Mark Texaria, and some guy named Leonard Nimoy. And also a Women of Wheatonverse panel. All interesting stuff coming, different things that happened at the FX Con in future episodes of Word Balloon. But that'll do it for this edition. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon, like bad Nigerian spam, is all over the internet. We're at iTunes, at Newsarama, at my MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. I am on Facebook under my own name, and you can follow me on Twitter. John Word Balloon is my Twitter moniker, all one word. And any questions or comments about the show, please hit our forums, which are at wordballoon.com. And also make sure you check out our archive at Word Balloon and at iTunes with all of our past episodes. Literally hundreds of episodes featuring some of your favorite comic book creators. And any other questions about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com.
Thanks for listening. Lots of cool stuff coming up in May in the days and weeks ahead. But until next time, thanks. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.